Woo!
Welcome to the Somewhere Called Play podcast. We are so happy to be with you today.
Happy Tuesday.
It's Tuesday.
And it's actually Tuesday for us over here. We usually record these things on Monday, David, so the pressure is on. We got to do this.
Well, we either record it on Monday, just like in the middle of the day, or we record it at Tuesday at 5 a.m. But we had an early call today for that Lululemon Further project, which was a really fun call, but it's pushed us back. So our backs are against the wall, Megan. This is like two outs, bottom of the ninth inning. We need to make a big play.
We got to do this. I believe. And you know what? I've been looking forward to these moments of pressure recently, both in podcasting, in life, in presentations, in training. I'm embracing it, which is not, that hasn't usually been my mentality.
Yeah.
I remember like thinking back to being a high school athlete or being a middle school athlete, and I would show up to those moments and be like, don't put me in for the penalty kick.
Yeah.
Not me, not me, not me. And now I'm like, put me in, coach. I'm ready.
Yeah, it's really interesting. So when we're watching sports, like the NBA or something, you'll often ask, so is Steph Curry nervous right now when it's in the fourth quarter? And I've noticed that shift in you, that like when you're asking that question, part of you is thinking, well, back when I played sports, even though you were one of the best players in the country, you're like top field hockey recruit in the country, it still seems like you were pretty nervous when the rubber hit the road at the end of games.
Oh, I was always nervous. Yeah. I was just a nervous creature growing up. I was nervous eating breakfast. I was nervous playing soccer, playing field hockey, doing basically whatever I was doing in life. And that shifted. I don't know what it is.
Well, your nerves discussion there, right there reminds me, we were actually just last night at dinner talking about, I had a seventh grade girlfriend, and I was so nervous before we did our phone calls. This was back when you had landlines, so we were using the main line, that I would write an outline of discussion topics just so that I wouldn't run out of things to talk about. And I specifically remember one of these outlines, my mom saved it, and I saw it when I came home from college and almost vomited from shame. It said, number three, discuss the rules of softball. And then it had subheadings beneath each one. So she played softball, and I wanted to find out the rules, apparently. So we both dealt with nerves as a kid. And you've really transitioned out of that. And do you have any reason why?
Well, I just need to call you out on something first. Yeah. So you said, I had a seventh grade girlfriend.
Yeah.
In prior iterations of the story, which I've heard before, I heard at dinner last night, I think we've actually heard it before in the podcast.
Yeah.
You've never said the word girlfriend. You always said something about there was a girl I was talking to. It was the first use of your word girlfriend. Did you have a seventh grade girlfriend?
I did.
How was she? What was her name?
Oh no, dude, I haven't talked to her to get permission. The names might
surely
be changed.
Surely she listens to the podcast.
Her name is Shirley. Surely she listens to the podcast. Exactly. Okay, so, but how have you transitioned out of that?
That's a good question. I mean, I feel like I put myself in enough situations where I recognize that the outcome doesn't matter.
Yeah.
And it's just about showing up. And I don't know, I give myself a lot more grace. Like, it truly doesn't matter. And it's kind of fun too.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like for me that like nervous, the pairing of like the nerves with the excitement, I'm really leaning into the excitement piece of it.
Yeah.
And it adds a little flavor, umami, to life. It's good.
I love it. I mean, it reminds me a little bit of what you said the other day. We were driving up here to Tahoe, where we are for Western States. We were out here for Broken Arrow. We're going to be talking about all of that today. But you're just like, you know, I'm just so comfortable with my naked body now.
That's true. Well, I don't remember. Oh, it was because I took a naked bath with Leo.
Yeah.
We didn't bring our like bath chair, so I had to hop in naked. And I was just walking around naked in front of my family. Yeah.
You were freeballing it.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know where that's come from either.
But I think it's a similar thing.
Yeah.
Like you've stopped caring about external narratives and have just started fully embracing like the good side of all of the tough things that you might have dealt with in the past.
Yeah, maybe some of that is parenting, actually.
Yeah.
I don't have enough time to deal with the shit. We got too much going on in life to feel those emotions. And I think I've recognized it, that my life's a lot easier without it.
Yeah, but even before that, I was noticing these changes in you as you developed. I mean, especially over the last few years. Maybe it's the podcast, honestly, because every single week we get on here, we're rather vulnerable in different ways.
We're rather naked too.
Yeah, yeah.
Except for today because it's freaking freezing in Tahoe. And this is the first podcast that we've done clothed. And I feel like there's going to be a lot of like tension going on because I don't usually podcast with you when you're clothed.
It might be more sexual tension though.
No, that's what I mean.
Oh yeah, yes, yeah. This is so much more. But you know, I just think you've made those transitions and it's very cool to see. And I mean, the podcast, we are naked emotionally and, you know, in vulnerability on this. And I think it might help because it just makes you realize at the end of the day, people love you for your missed shots at the end of the fourth quarter as much as they love you for making everyone.
Exactly. And I think for me, the big key point is I actually love me.
Yeah.
Like before, that didn't matter to me quite as much. It was more like my own internal volatility that was really, really challenging. And I think for once, I truly don't care about like the end outcome, yeah. like truly, truly. And I love me some me.
Yeah. You love you. You love yourself. Just like vulva hanging out.
Yeah. Is it really hanging out?
Do your vulva hang low? Do it wobble to and fro?
It does, I think. Okay. Yeah, totally. In a beautiful life-affirming way.
Perfect way to start the podcast. And we have the best episode for you today. We're going to be talking a little bit about some lessons from graduation. Megan officially walked across the stage for her PhD program. She now is a double doctor. Talk about broken arrow spectating. Talk about some takeaways from training of these broken arrow sky races that are going to be great. An amazing new study that just came out yesterday on low energy availability. One of the better ones we've ever seen. Then a big Western States preview. We're not going to dig too deep into like exact predictions, but we are going to predict winning time, and we have some spicy takes on that. And then finally, we're going to talk about hot takes, and there might be some cool things on drug testing and GI system in there, but they might also get kicked to next week because we already spent, let's see, 5 minutes talking about vulvas.
Good, good discussion. Well, this is actually usually my favorite episode of the year. We got Broken Arrow. Yeah. We got Western States. I'm going to add more pressure to this episode and say this is usually my favorite of all time.
Well, it's just so much fun to get to spend this time together, especially when life has been a little bit of a whirlwind, which brings us to graduation. So last week, we flew out to California with baby Leo and got to see your parents who came out to celebrate with us. So we didn't get that much like purely alone time other than when we were just passed out in bed. So this is a chance for us to get together and just connect one-on-one, dangerously close to this mic because we're in a room with a few echoes, so we're getting like really, really close. We're using our NPR voices to talk about vulvas.
The NPR voice comes out.
Yeah.
Also, the jokes are coming out, and you are primed this weekend because my parents came to graduation, and they're divorced, and they came, and we all stayed in the same Airbnb. In retrospect, as we were flying out, I was like, Megan, why did you do this to yourself? This is going to be extremely stressful.
Yeah.
And you know what? It was not. Partially because I'm in this like, fuck it mentality, and I was like, you know, they both said they could do this, so I'm going to take their word for it. But also because, David, you were hilarious. You stepped up. I felt like you recognized the awkward nature of the situation, and you responded with some of the best humor I've ever seen you have, and it was inspiring. I feel like at some point we should just really just do like a four-way podcast interview with a divorced couple. You would be hilarious. You would be so funny.
So after your parents got divorced, I love both your parents, but after they got divorced, I read a lot on what it's like to be the child of divorced parents, because it's, you know, a unique experience that a lot of people have. And I read that basically for the rest of your life, even when they have a good relationship, there's this kind of underlying tension, mm-hmm. right? And my philosophy with tension in general is if instead I can take like the elephant out of the room, it's going to be there. But if instead of that elephant, everyone's looking at me looking like a fucking loser, it helps everybody.
So you're just gonna make jokes about vulvas.
Yeah, just, but that type of thing. Yeah, I mean, I did a lot of that on this trip.
Actually, you made a joke about a dog vulva at one point. Yeah, yeah. You really went deep.
Yeah, that was interesting. So people probably saw this, but there was a story about a guy using a park facility in Pennsylvania. They put up a surveillance thing mm-hmm. because people were stealing hand sanitizer, and they found out that he was having sex with his dog, and it was a professor at Penn State University. So that led to a number of jokes across the weekend. You know, obviously it's a very serious situation. We take it seriously, but if you can't laugh at a Penn State professor having sex with his dog, what can you laugh at?
It was a recurring bit. I also laughed at the fact that it was an East Coast drill. Every time I show up to an East Coast trailhead, there's kind of this underlying tone of me feeling like I'm going to get murdered.
Yeah.
I don't know what it is. Like, the trailheads are usually empty. There's like forests like that are deeply thicketed. And it kind of seems like the perfect setup for a murder podcast.
Yeah.
But maybe it's just the perfect setup for a dog being fucked.
Yeah. Yeah. Both are tragedies. For some reason, the dog being abused makes me feel worse than the murders, which probably—
Does it really?
It probably means I need to check like how my brain is structured about tragedy in general, because you read about so much human tragedy, but like pet tragedy is like—
Oh, it's so sad.
It's so sad. Yeah. So yeah, I probably need to recalibrate that. And we probably also, instead of talking about dogs having, I don't know, I guess it's not consensual just
that
by
is
definition.
100% not consensual.
It's not consensual.
Yes.
But in better news, we get to talk about you walking across the stage. They actually let you carry baby Leo at the Stanford, it's at the Stanford Medical School because it's the, you were just a part of the medical school graduation, but as a PhD, not just an MD.
It was so much fun. I got to carry Leo across the stage, and most importantly, I didn't drop him.
Yeah.
So in my medical school graduation 5 years ago, someone actually dropped their baby on the stage. Do you remember that?
No.
How could you not remember that?
I mean, I was kind of dazed out.
Yeah, I mean, these graduation hours, ceremonies are really, really long. And honestly, it provided some nice color to a very long procession that
you
was happening.
Red from the baby's blood.
But I did not drop Leo. I was very excited. Yeah. But he did great. He got this little, like, they gave him kind of this, I don't know what you would call it. It was like a diploma. And he ate it.
Yeah, he ate it. And actually, I got to hand them to you at the front of the stage because, like, I was officially the handler. And right before I handed them to you, I turned him around and faced this audience, which was probably like 800 people or 1,000 people, stretching for as far as the eye can see. And I held him up like baby Simba. And everyone made a good, they all laughed at that and also went, oh, which is pretty cool.
It was so much fun. It was really meaningful. I mean, I wasn't sure I was going to go to graduation because it was Broken Arrow weekend. And I was like, okay, we got a trail race and we got walking at graduation.
Yeah.
But I was glad I did it. It was meaningful family time. I felt like it was a fun closure on like being a student at Stanford. Granted, I didn't know a single person in the graduating class, which was a little, I was the only graduating student from my program, but literally did not know a single other MD or PhD student as I was sitting up there.
I like that. That's my introvert's dream.
Yeah, right?
I feel like I could get through a program and not meet a single person. I actually, when I went to law school, had to make a concerted effort. And this is what I recommend. If you're out there and you ever start a new program, move to a new place, start a new job, be that ridiculous person. Learn every name on the first day. Like, write them down after you meet people. Use people's names and always say hi in hallways. Be that outgoing person. Because I didn't do that in undergrad. And then when I went to law school, I did. And it made my experience so much better. That being said, I do think that just standing in a corner and not meeting anyone would be my baseline setting.
Well, I did that actually in the beginning of the program. So I met a bunch of master students and we kind of formed these groups and they helped me with my homework and things along those lines. But they all graduated 2 years ago. Yeah. So I didn't know a single person.
Yeah, you make friends to get help with your homework. Is exactly. Essentially what you're saying.
Yeah, it's very, very transactional.
Friends with benefits.
Yes, 100%.
So we had so much fun there because one of the things we got to do is the Airbnb was right next to Edgewood Park in California. And I think both of us found that we might be better at high intensity efforts than we ever were, which is fascinating because on this podcast, we talk a lot about intensity controlled training, where a lot of our intervals are not going all out. Like, we're trying to avoid VO2 plus efforts outside of extreme moderation. But while we were there, we both did a few efforts that were basically all out. You did just one, but it was up there with the best performances you've ever done. And same with me, like I was running my grade adjusted paces in the mid fours, feeling wonderful. And it's kind of a cool reflection on even as we age, this is both of our birthday weeks too. I'm about to turn 35. Megan's about to turn 33.
We have a lot going on over here.
Yeah.
We should really officially move our birthdays to sometime other than the Broken Arrow and Western States week because it's actually overload. Like, I love birthdays. I'm like, it is too much. We have a lot going on. There's like nothing more we need to celebrate.
But I don't know. It's such a good celebration week. It's kind of a good time.
It's really fun. Yeah, it is fun.
But even as we're, you know, aging just a little bit, we're getting better at that stuff from the focus on moderate intensity and then high intensity, like strides and short things. And then putting it together in Edgewood Park was incredibly enriching, I think.
It was a very cool experience. So we've been having this kind of builds. We've been having Saturday date series. So on Saturdays, we have this like tempo date and we usually select a climbs. Like in Colorado, it's like 20, 30 minute climbs.
Yeah.
But here in California, we had Edgewood in our backyard and we've never run in Edgewood before. So we've covered almost all of the Bay Area trails except for this one. So it's fitting that our Airbnb was in the backyard of Edgewood and we showed up and there was a variety. There's a few, like a handful of segments that we were eyeing. And it was fun because I felt like our prior tempo efforts were allowing us to unlock VO2 on some of these segments. And it was this fun progression of getting to build tempo date series into a few more VO2 efforts and to actually feel good in those.
And that's a good lesson for training in general for people. Like, as you're doing this pyramidal structure with a lot of moderate intensity, pulse in harder efforts, right?
Yeah.
Like, don't do it every week. Don't even do it every like 2 or 3 weeks where you're going harder for a short period of time. And, you know, you're kind of limited on how hard you can go on a 40-minute climb. That'll be thresholdy. But if you're doing a 7-minute climb or 4-minute climb, it's going to be all out. And those polarized stimuli, pulsing them in every, let's say, 3 to 5 weeks can be massively beneficial to get short-term gains. So like, we got those gains and we got to experience them at sea level. And it's especially fun to do it in Edgewood Park because a podcast listener sent in this amazing article from Ask Men, which is kind of a funny website.
I've never heard of it before.
Yeah.
Have you heard of it before?
Ask Men? Oh, yeah. It was big like back when I was a kid, like high school or that sort of thing. I went to Ask Men a lot to learn about things like, you know,
how to bang your 7th grade girlfriend that I still don't have a name on.
I was going to say sex, but not, that was not a consideration at that point in my life. I don't think anyone who's ever outlined a phone conversation has ever, you know, had to be concerned themselves with that unless it involves their dog. Oh God. But also I feel like with that, it's the worst title of a website ever.
Especially because, now. I mean, I feel like maybe 20 years ago that was okay. I feel like these days it's like...
Well, the thing is, it poses a question that also gives an answer. It's like,
yes, yeah.
Ask men? No, thank you. It's like, easy answer to that. But it was on the San Francisco 49ers. So they had a dynasty in the 1980s and 1990s, this football team. And, you know, football players don't really do endurance training. And what this article said is that Jerry Rice, the best receiver of all time, maybe the best player of all time in the NFL history, got a lot of his teammates to use Edgewood Park. And they called it the Hill. It was actually one of the segments that we did out there. And it's very steep, actually. It's like 1,000 feet of climbing. And it's very interesting to think about these incredibly, you know, big, fast football players
doing 1,000 feet of climbing
three times a week.
Mind blowing to me.
Three times a week in the off season.
Well, do you know how painful that must be for them?
Yeah.
I mean, these are fast twitch athletes, and to do something like that has to be an immense amount of pain.
Yeah. And this is a quote from Roger Craig, who was one of their best players. It was the toughest thing I ever did in my life. I threw up a couple times going up this trail. I was a football player. I never run this far. I was only good for 100 yards. I ran track and stuff, but as far as running 4 miles, that was unheard of. One of our coaches said, just hang in there. So I did it for a few weeks with him, and I started loving it. I could feel it. I was getting in great shape. So I introduced it to some of my teammates. I said, man, you guys need to come out here and run this trail.
Well, I'm so glad they were feeling pain, because I was feeling an immense amount of pain out
were
there.
You?
I haven't done a VO2 effort. It's been a solid 2 years since I've done a VO2 effort.
And it's interesting, yeah.
I got excited. I got very much the same like podcast nervous energy, but in a good way. I was looking forward to this pain.
And there was one segment in particular that you had to push on, because it was a very fast segment. Some of them varied, right? Like I of course go to Strava and map out this route that is designed around getting Strava crowns. And most of them you could go up at threshold effort and be fine and get this crown.
And my task was to hang on your wheel.
Yeah.
So it was a fun way to run it, because you were kind of like ratcheting me up in terms of the pace. And my job was to hang on. And it was a fun challenge for me as a competitor. But there was this one segment, a 5-minute segment that was mostly all out.
Yes.
And it hurt so bad. My quote to you at the end of this was...
I'm gonna actually read this one.
You're gonna read my quote? I said it.
For dramatic effect. Well, I'll set the tone and then you can say the quote.
Okay, great.
So she does the 5-minute segment and it's all out. But then I make her keep going, because there's also a longer segment. And, you know, it's a good training stimulus sometimes to go out too hard and then have to dial back. So she dialed back toward easier than threshold and finished the climb.
But it was a 20-minute climb. So I did 5 minutes at VO2 effort, then kind of had a minute where I spent clearing lactate, and then finished the 20-minute climb more around threshold tempo effort.
Definitely. Yeah. And so it ends on this steep little hill, same place that the San Francisco 49ers ended it, where it's just straight up for a short period of time. We get to the top and I'm finally like, okay, you can stop now, because I knew we were at the end of the segment. And then Megan gives the quote of the year as it relates to workouts.
Which was, my vagina was fully lactic. I haven't had that experience in a long time. It's been like since the track days, but there is a sort of feeling when your vagina goes lactic, and it is a strange feeling, especially postpartum.
Yeah.
But I guess maybe in the fitting realm of this podcast, my vulva is lactic.
You also said it multiple times. You're like,
I mean, I haven't experienced this in at least a couple of years. And after being postpartum, it was a unique experience.
I think my vagina went lactic is what I specifically remember you saying.
Well, I'm translating it now from, I think it was definitely fucking lactic.
Very interesting description. I didn't know. Maybe.
Do your gonads ever go lactic?
No, that's never happened to me.
I'm sure it'd be very deeply concerning. I mean, I feel like you have, I kind of have like a nice relationship with things down there. I'm like, but I feel like for you, you have a high level of concern sometimes. I feel like if this happened, you probably would not compete.
I feel like, yes. I would not be an athlete if I was worried about my situation going lactic.
Yes.
That would be concerning. But I'm curious if other listeners have this issue with vagina going lactic. How does it feel exactly?
I mean, it literally feels like things are numb down there. And then sometimes you like pee yourself a little bit. So I don't know if anyone has ever talked about this, but this has been a unique experience for me. Like almost always in track 5Ks, the last 400 meters, I would feel this way. Like it was like, I just couldn't feel anything down there.
Okay.
Yeah. And maybe that's not going lactic.
Yeah.
I associate it with lactic acid, but who knows?
So we'll have to at least get confirmation from at least one listener that they've felt this too. Otherwise, we'll probably need to go to the gynecologist.
Nah, it's fine.
That's how we approach problems in this house.
Yeah, that's how we brush off medical concerns. We'll be okay.
We actually got sent a tweet on Instagram from a podcast listener that said, your vagina's name is the name of the last podcast you listened to. And we realized that we have the perfect podcast for that prompt.
We have the best vagina name.
Yeah.
Actually, I feel like, I don't know if we should have like many, many thousands of vaginas out there named Somewhere Call Play. Maybe I can own it.
No. Megan, you do not own this vagina name.
We have said vagina on this episode more than we have in any other episode. I promise if this is the first episode you're listening to, they're like, what the fuck is wrong with you
guys? We were just on a female athlete research call. So.
Well, it did not sound really like this.
Primed.
Yes, yeah.
But like, I feel like we need to democratize the vagina name. So some work, all play. Just some work for sure. Like,
oh,
that's the nature.
I mean, when your vagina goes lactic, it is a lot of work. I was out there thinking and I was like, you know, I've had a lot of play.
Yeah.
And it's really important that you also mix in some work. And I was feeling like I was in a good harmonic balance.
That's perfect. I love it. Just such a fun week. And I think to actually give you a takeaway from that, be confident that when you go all out, when you do this type of training with very high intensity, short strides, like 30 seconds or less, mixed with more moderate training, including some longer tempos, you'll be stronger than ever. And this is like what I talked about a few weeks ago when I did a 3-minute effort all out and outperformed anything I'd ever done. This ability to process lactate, even though it is most relevant at relaxed efforts, once you go harder, just makes you be able to buffer the lactate better. That's how, you know, Grayson Murphy wins a world championship or Eli Hemming wins Broken Arrow. It's because they're aerobic monsters that can then push above VO2 and process the lactate from it and clear it really fast.
And I think special, like using VO2 as like a special focus every once in a while can be super helpful.
In short doses.
In short doses.
How long would you say a dose of like a more VO2 focus would be for you, like training a pro athlete that's not doing 5Ks, like that's doing like half marathons and above?
Do you mean within the context of a build or in terms of like the time of the exact VO2 effort?
Within the context of a build.
Oh, I mean, I think you can get like, even if you do just 2 weeks where you have like one workout each week, I think that's enough to really start to light the system on fire if you're heading into a more intense base race.
I totally agree. And that's, so that's basically the principle, you know, that we recommend. So congrats on your graduation.
Thank you. Yeah.
Your playful situation.
It was really nice to graduate. Yeah. I feel like ever since I've like started this PhD program, I've had a fear that I'm not going to handle some sort of logistics that are going to allow me to graduate. So we walked into the graduation ceremony and like one of the first things I did was open the pamphlet just to make sure my name was there.
I did the same thing.
Did you really?
I couldn't find it right away.
Yeah.
Because like the way they were listed, it was kind of confusing alphabetically.
Yeah.
Did you have trouble finding it? Because like it took
I found it.
Okay.
Yes.
It took me a second. I was like, oh fuck.
I had a moment of panic though. And I was like, I should really, while my parents are here, I should really make sure. Like if it was just us, we would have a good laugh over the fact that like maybe I forgot to do something that would have enabled me to walk at graduation. But with my parents there, I felt this added layer of pressure to actually walk, but I was in the book.
I would have made some good jokes to soften the blow. And so final thing on your graduation, on your PhD, I made no secret that I did not agree with going to this PhD at the time that you made the decision because we were settled in Colorado. We were going to have to go move back to California, live in like a 300 square foot box. And it just felt like going backwards in our lives when you had so many opportunities. Obviously, it was the right decision, now in retrospect, but it reminds me of Zach Miller's great article, Heart Not Smart. Go read this in I Run Far. It was about his experience at the World Championships, where he went out more conservatively than he usually does. Mm-hmm. Zach usually races from the front, and he described that, you know, yeah, it led to a pretty good result, but part of it did not give him the fulfillment with racing that he would often get. And so here's a quote from that article. What I'm trying to say is that there is something to running from the heart. Perhaps some people run best with their head, but I'm not sure that's me. Maybe the best strategy is to run with both, to figure out how to use the head for tactics and the heart for motivation. But if I had to choose between the two, I'd take the heart any day. It simply has a habit of finding its way.
That's an incredible quote. Yeah. Maybe I'm just being a little bitch here, but couldn't we argue that that's that concept and like thinking about this intuitively is using both your head and your heart? Like if you decide to use your heart, isn't that the brain being involved in the process to say like, my heart is stronger than my brain?
I don't think we're talking about neurology here. I think we're talking about the metaphor of
I understand how, I understand like, okay. I understand the neurological principle and yes,
all right,
I
get that. Back to first principles. The English language is this thing that is not always direct. It's sometimes
No. I'm fully aware of that. But I mean, I do think though that like, there's an element, like if you decide to use your heart, that is your brain stepping in and understanding.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. But I think in making this decision, you know, you really led with your heart.
In making the PhD decision. Okay, well, we're going to circle back to this argument that we had. This is to date, I would say our biggest argument. It lasted like 48 hours of our life, which is a long time for us.
Yeah.
And I would say it was both head and heart. I'll disagree.
Okay. Yeah. I don't think so.
Yeah. But I look back on the PhD.
I mean, I really think in retrospect, you were not thinking that far down the line. So I do think it was your heart. You know, it's very much like Zach going out hard. Like, I think your skill set is not thinking long term, like, which is great. It makes you, you know, superwoman. And it works out. And so sometimes you're given lessons that things will work out if you lead with your heart, and it has. So maybe you're right. I'm all head.
But I feel like this is why we're in a good relationship.
No, for sure. Yeah.
I would say, though, I was thinking long term. And I think my thought process with the PhD was starting a PhD. It's like starting a race.
Yeah.
Starting a race that you're not sure of. I would much rather start that race and find out. And yeah. DNF, like say I got 2 years into the PhD, I would be willing to pull the plug if it wasn't fulfilling. But the whole process to me was so meaningful. And I was like, I'm going to start this PhD with the understanding that if it's not fulfilling, I am not a failure for dropping out.
Okay.
And it was so fulfilling to me, and it worked out. We got lucky in several regards. So we got to live in Colorado and be in California at the same time. But I think that was a big part of my decision-making is like, I'm going to give myself the freedom to see where this goes, and it doesn't have to be a finish.
Yeah. And I mean, I guess my big message to people is lead with the heart a little bit more, a little bit more than people like me do.
Maybe my message is to lead with the head a little bit more.
Oh
yeah.
Maybe we're just saying that we respect the other person.
Yeah. I like that.
And their approach. Is that what we're saying?
Yeah. I like that. Yeah. I uplift you.
You uplift me. Yeah. And I uplift your vulva.
I was going to make that. I was going to make that exact same joke. Okay. And I was like, we've said vulva at least 8 times now. And
we're just getting started. You better fucking believe it. But one thing, you know, the final thing on the graduation that made me a little sad was because you didn't know anybody, when they called your name, you didn't get like the scream. So like everyone that's ever been to graduation knows it's kind of a competition after a while to see who gets the loudest screams at as people walk.
See, that is my nightmare, actually. Yeah. I don't want to be that person that goes up and everyone's like, yeah! Like that to me, it's like I've always been the type of person that would rather hide in a corner. So I'd rather just walk across quietly with Leo.
Well, did you hear me scream? It was like,
I didn't actually.
It was delayed. It took like 2 seconds.
But I was so focused on carrying Leo, I didn't hear a thing.
What I was thinking is a good startup would be to seed the audience, like to give out little handouts where you give some sort of incentive to people to scream for your graduate. So that when like you walked across the stage, like 60 people just lose their fucking mind. And everyone's like, wow, that must be the best graduate that's ever lived.
I love that startup idea. Do you want to hear my startup idea?
What is it?
If you have divorced parents that you can just like Uber in, or you can like DoorDash a comedian to come hang out with you, because it is so much fun. Yeah. It was hilarious.
The thing is, you need a bad comedian. So sometimes the jokes absolutely don't land, and essentially just redirects any awkwardness onto the person trying to make the joke.
You were just swimming in the awkwardness. It was great.
Yeah, that's something that's really changed about me. I kind of enjoy it now.
Well, I feel like my approach with pressure is now you with awkwardness.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We're crushing it.
Yeah, I like it.
We're doing so good. And speaking of crushing it, Broken Arrow. So this is a big topic. We're going to get into a lot of different training discussions. But first, we had our first ever race spectating experience with baby Leo in a major way, which was quite wonderful. But there was a specific time I'll really remember where Eli Hemming, one of our athletes and one of the best athletes in the world, I think now everyone sees that he actually might be the best in the world. Watch the fuck out.
He is so good.
But on the second lap, he was making his move, and we were specifically positioned right where the move was going to happen, much like where Grayson made her move at the Worlds. And Leo, meanwhile, was just kind of sitting, lying down in the bushes.
Okay. You're making this sound a little bit too...
He was literally lying down in the bushes.
Like... We created him a nice bed of puffy coats, and he was sleeping on the bed with his binky.
In bushes.
On a nice flat part of land.
Where it was cold and windy.
On an East Coast trailhead, alone, unattended. Yes.
Dogs everywhere. And as Eli ran by, you know, cheering him on, doing all this thing. And then Megan took a video of it. You can see right at the end of the video, I start sprinting. Because as Liam did it, he's just bawling all out in the bushes, probably because he heard us screaming. So our first experience watching races with Leo is a baby absolutely going ballistic over in the woods.
Well, he also went ballistic with joy, too, because we gave so many woohoos and huzzas out there. It was so uplifting that I almost lost my voice that night.
Yeah.
We said so many woohoos and huzzas. We got to see the pack come through twice. And it was one of my favorite race experiences.
How many people would you say were podcast listeners?
Like a scary amount. Like 75%. Yeah. It was pretty wild.
We love you all. It was so fun to see you. Hopefully you saw that like the energy we bring to the podcast is the same one we bring.
We took a lot of selfies with people out in the middle of races too.
How cool is that? Like, people stopped to take pictures with us.
And some of them were taking a long time, and I was starting to get nervous energy. I know. Was like, okay, we can do this really fast. And they're like, no, it's got to be a good selfie.
What I started doing when people did stop is, like, in the Tour de France or bike races, when someone's going uphill, sometimes a spectator will put their hand on their back and help them up the hill. That's what I did as people started, like, to get their bike going again. But it was incredibly cool. And the big reflection I have before we get into some of the elite races and considerations and training is, it is wildly inspiring to watch these races as they unfold the entire time, like throughout the entire pack. Like the people at the front, I always reflect on, okay, that's remarkable. But the people that are in the middle and the back, maybe way more remarkable to me. Like, athletes are doing things that are just so cool and crazy. This course was covered in thick snow with deep down, like steep downhills. And people were out there pushing themselves and doing things that very few people on earth could do. It just so happened that they congregate in this one place. And so we wanted to uplift you, whatever your experience is in these types of events, even if you're just debating doing your first 5K or something, because wow, it's remarkable to see people get vulnerable like this in competitive settings.
It was so inspiring to me. I feel like I have enough inspiration to last like 4 months after seeing Broken Arrow. And
so true.
I think my new life goal is just to go plant myself at races and say woohoo and huzzah in ridiculous ways and soak in the energy that comes from that.
It was so fun. And baby Leo was going crazy for people. He was so happy. Every time people would say his name, he would just smile and light up. I'm sure a lot of you listeners got a big baby Leo smile out there.
It was so wild. What I thought was interesting too, so Broken Arrow, obviously like very technical, lots of snow this year. There was kind of this interesting like polarizing accordion effect where there were a lot less poles at the front of the pack and then more poles in the back. And it was helpful actually to see the whole race play out, because we talk a lot about training on here and we've had stances on here about poles. And it's interesting to see how like different, how different race strategies might impact decisions like that.
Yeah. And I think often, I mean, we try to talk to everyone, and especially with training, like everyone is an elite athlete. It's all the same chemical properties. We try to make it broadly applicable. I think sometimes with logistics, I'm not thinking enough about the back of the pack. Mm-hmm. So like,
I agree. And that was the realization I had out there.
Yeah. Like we're extremely pole skeptical. actually on last week's Patreon episode, we got into deep details about our feelings on poles. Actually our last week's Patreon episode was one of the most spicy ever. If you want to get some heavy duty spice, 30 minutes of answering listener questions in a really unvarnished way that makes this podcast look like it's PG.
I was going to say, if that was unvarnished, what is this?
Exactly.
Yeah.
So patreon.com/swap, SWAP. There you can get our really big poll feelings. But what I want to do in the podcast in general is just try to think a little bit more about every athlete as we talk about each of the topics.
Because every athlete's journey is so wildly cool.
And also wildly different, you know?
Exactly.
Like someone that's finishing the 23K in 4 or 5 hours is having a very different experience than Eli at an hour and a half. And it also motivates different decisions, especially I think with logistics. So on Broken Arrow, the big thing that separated it this year, it's become one of the biggest sky races in the US. I think it's probably one of the 5 biggest races on the calendar.
And the vibes of the race are so cool. If you're looking for a race, like this is totally unsponsored.
Yeah.
Broken Arrow is one of the best community-based, like soul-filling events. Go for it.
Yeah, it is the best. Definitely do this race next year. But this year had an anomalous amount of snow. I've never seen it like this in all the years we've been coming to Tahoe.
Tahoe is so, so wet right now. Like so wet. I did a run yesterday and it only got to 7,000 feet and there was a bonkers amount of snow.
Yeah. And some of these downhills involved, I mean, you're running on 6 feet of snow, which was kind of like softly packed at times.
Like running on mashed potatoes.
Yeah, mashed potatoes for sure. And it just changed the way the races unfolded a little bit. And we'll get into exactly how. But first, it was a great weekend for SWAP. In total, we had 7 podiums across the 3 races of athletes we coach, which was really fun. And I think the snow actually probably helped our team in retrospect, because yes, there were a couple people that suffered because their form isn't as conducive to snow. But I think for the most part, going into a race with the mindset that like, you're emotionally okay with being thrown off your plan is key. And I hope that's one thing we give athletes the context for, is that don't have plans. Like I always say, I tell the athletes, like spreadsheets are great, but spreadsheets are just, you know, a way essentially to deal with anxiety, not a way to actually race.
That's such a great point. And also too, the snow was, I felt like a great experience to practice eating shit as well. Actually, the advice that I gave to athletes was fall 5 times.
Yeah.
And snow is a great chance to get to practice that. I feel like, honestly, if you struggle with technical running, try running on snow, because if you fall, like I feel like you learn to fall on snow because the consequences are less, but
unless you're on a ridge.
Depends. Yes. Actually, I was like, I should really qualify that.
But no, I said the same thing. I mean, I told some athletes in the 50K, try to fall 30 times, because if you fall 30 times, it's a sign you're running this the right way. I hope they actually didn't in retrospect, because when I saw it, I'm like, oh, those are actually steeper grades than I thought.
Well, it's fun to watch. There's so many somersaults and tumbles, but to watch. So Allie McLaughlin, she won the 23K and she did so in a really resounding fashion, but watching her run down the snow was a masterclass in snow running. She was, I mean, it was like, she was running like the snow didn't exist.
It was
like, she was just running on a flat trail. It was pretty wild.
And I think it's interesting to think about how descending relates to other life choices. So
she's a base jumper.
She's a base jumper.
She basically was base jumping on the snow. Yeah. She
skydives, does all of that. And that's exactly like, it was almost like, so Grayson Murphy was planning on doing the race. I would have loved to have seen Grayson do it just because I would have loved to see how Grayson attacks the snow, knowing how great she is at everything. And seeing Allie do it, it reminded me a lot of her at Mount Marathon last year, where I'm like, wow, that is wild. Like, and so it's interesting to think about how life decisions incorporate with our trail running in actions. Like, Grayson's told me that mountain biking has helped her immensely in, you know, running downhills.
For me, it helps see the lines. Yeah. Like, I think mountain biking, you have to process the lines so fast that it makes trail running, like the line processing, a little bit slower and easier.
Yeah. Okay. So quick rundown of the three races. First, the vertical kilometer was basically all snow. It was like 75% snow straight uphill.
Be my nightmare.
Yeah. It sounds like kind of,
I don't love snow running.
So for men, Andrea Rosten won. I believe he's Italian. And Anna Gibson won for women. Anna is a champion track runner, right?
Yeah, and she runs distances from the 800 meters. She's a 204 800 meter runner, all the way up to 5K, 10K, and then now hopping in the 23K race in addition to the VK as well.
And points out, running uphill is just your speed. Like, don't get too caught up in all of the details of like every other variable. It's like, if you get faster at a 5K or 10K, you're going to become a better climber, guaranteed. Mm-hmm. And if you try to get better at hiking or using poles or whatever, you're growth is going to be capped out at a certain percentage that you can get from that. But if you improve your running, you can improve by essentially however much you improve your running economy, you can improve by that percentage in running uphill.
And to hold true to what we were just talking about, I think that principle actually applies even more to the back of the pack.
Yeah.
Because I think the margins of improving it in running are higher. So like, say Anna improves in running and she improves 2%.
Yeah.
But someone in the back of the pack may improve 35, 40% in running. And when you apply that to the uphill, the gains are incredible.
Yeah. So always be doing that one speed workout a week, including, especially if you're in the back of the pack, like that's all it takes. One of the questions we got from Patreon that was really interesting is they saw a photo of Grayson at Worlds, who, as she was leaning forward, and she's like, in the questioner was asked, should I lean forward on climbs? Because they've been told you should keep an upright posture. This is one of the most frustrating places of like runner's world advice I've ever seen. It's like, you should run with an upright posture on uphills. It's like, absolutely not. You should lean forward and get the fuck dirty.
Oh yeah. I feel like, don't run like you're on a magazine cover.
No,
that
no.
is slow, slow, slow. Yeah. Actually, as we were standing there cheering, one of the big things I was doing was complimenting form. Yeah. So there were some people that were leaning over beautifully. Yeah. And I was like, look at that forward lean. Or people that were running the climb when it was clearly something that, you know, they were granny gearing it and wasn't something that coming easy. I was like, look at that run. So it was fun to see that in action, uplift it.
And our general advice is to try to mimic the grade in your head. Like, not actually, but it's a good way to think about it. So if it's a 4% grade, you kind of have a 4% forward lean. If it's a 30% grade, you're leaning really far forward.
And I think that applies even more if you're hiking compared to running.
Yeah.
Like, it's hard to lean that far forward if you're running.
Definitely. But even then, like, you look at how Eli or Grayson run, they definitely have like a little bit of a pitch forward in how their center of gravity is. So it's more about your center of gravity, and the lean forward is kind of a method to it. But I think one reason this comes so naturally to me is because of my posture more generally.
Oh, my posture's horrible.
Both of us.
Do you ever notice that? We were just on a Zoom call together and we were just hunched over like grandparents. It was great.
That's what we're doing right now. So we have the mic right between us.
But it's intimate because we're closer to each other. We're hunching into each other.
Yeah, we're kind of making a heart with our backs and our heads. So our heads are connecting in the middle at the bottom end of the heart right next to the mic, which I think makes us better at that. But when you climb, that's one of the, actually in my intro email to athletes, the very first email I ever send, the only form tip I have is lean forward on climbs. And you know, practice it, make sure you're not overdoing it. You can overdo all of this, but it's a huge benefit, especially for steep trails. Okay, on to the 46K. The winners were Mike Sinceri and Helen Mino Faulkner. Quick story about Mike Sinceri, actually. Great guy, but I didn't really know who he was in 2019 because I just had never met him before. So I didn't know him by sight. I knew him by name. And at Western States on Friday, they have a family and friends race, which is like a really low key thing.
Well, it's low key unless you're like David Roach and Mike Sinceri.
Well, I was like, I'm just going to go, you know, I'll win by 3 minutes. It'll be fun. And my athletes will be motivated by seeing their coach send it. And so I get out there and I'm like a mile and a half in, expecting myself to just be like fully clear. And a guy comes by me moving so fast and absolutely dusts my ass.
And what was your mindset there? Were you excited? Were you like, oh, this is going to make me better? Or are you like, fuck this shit. I got to race.
This shit. I didn't want to race.
Yeah.
And also, I didn't want to get my ass kicked in front of my athletes. I was running with my ego at that point. And he beat my ass. And that was Mike Sinceri. So I've ever since then, and he's a great guy. So
do you get really excited when he wins? Is it like validation to you?
No, I mean, I get excited.
Going back to 2019.
I get excited when he wins because he's amazing. Like, he's a human, not because of that. I'm good on that now. I try to let the ego get dropped on the floor sometimes. And then Helen Mino Faulkner, who's a local, actually, and she crushed the downhill descents. It was awesome to see. And actually, it brings up a question, advice we gave to our athletes about the accordion effect in the snow. Mm-hmm. So we had three of the six podiums in the 50K were swap athletes who crushed it. But one of the things we said to them is, in this type of race, the idea that you're moving up in the second half is probably not going to happen, because people at the front are going to feed off each other and get confidence on what is reasonable to do in the snow. Mm-hmm. So like, you're going to get packs that form and then like kind of coagulate together, like little amoeba.
That's such a good description. Is it? That was a beautiful use of coagulation.
Yeah. And yeah. Amoeba.
Uh-huh. Look
I'm
at you.
Rocking it. Yeah. Okay. You know what I was trying to do there? I decided to abandon it. We don't need to make...
I actually don't know what you were trying to do.
I was
trying to
make another vulva joke.
Of course. Yeah.
I need to be the awkward turtle.
All coagulation jokes lead
to the vulva. We probably have a lot of divorced listeners that are like, or, you know, kids of divorced parents who probably need a little bit of awkwardness right now. But, you know, I said, unlike most races, this is a race where you kind of probably got to go to the front, or at least the front pack or two, if you want to compete for the podium. So it was interesting to see how that played out.
Yeah, it definitely played out that way. That being said, I had some athletes actually that had a faster second lap and really moved up in the field. So I don't think there was a perfect way to answer that, but I think like the accordion effect, we definitely did see that.
And I think it's mainly if you are going for podium, essentially.
True.
Because outside, I mean, the problem is if you go for podium, there's a very high chance of DNFing at that type of race too. So
do you think that's going to translate to Western states?
Absolutely not.
Yes.
Not at all.
Yeah.
Totally different experience.
Yep, I agree. And
do you want to get, I'll probably get to that in a few minutes.
We'll get to that in a few minutes, yeah.
We have a lot of thoughts about Western states this year that are quite spicy. And then finally, the 23K. We actually got to be there for this race after Megan's graduation. They changed the course last second and pushed it back an hour and a half.
Which is so hard. Yeah. We had athletes that were already done their warm-up by the time they pushed it back an hour and a half.
Yeah. And it was so funny. Tabor and Eli Hemming, follow them everywhere you can. They are the best people.
They are so chill pre-race.
We were hanging out with them in the Solomon tent. We're like 40 minutes before the start. And, you know, it got pushed back an hour and a half, so they need to eat something. Tabor's there eating a Kirkland brand protein bar.
It looked more like a brownie than a protein bar.
Or something. Like,
yeah.
And I'm like, that's special shit when you can have any nutrition sponsor in the world and you're out there just munching on some Kirklands. Like your Costco brand meatballs or something. And the race was changed to up, down, just like last year. Big climb, big descent, big climb, big descent. And the men's race was fascinating because Chad Hull passed Eli Hemming on the first descent, much like Tove Alexanderson passed Grayson last week. And Chad ran a 4:15 mile on a mile that included snow in the middle of a race that was 23K.
It was so fast. And he's a 2:12 marathoner. So
still, that is insane.
It's bonkers. Yeah. And it was fascinating because I feel like the up, down really played like Worlds. And as soon as we saw that happen, I had a feeling that it was going to work in Eli's favor.
Just like Worlds.
Yeah. I feel like on up, down, if you send that first downhill, it's hard to come back and rally for the future ups.
Yeah. Your quads are just going to be trashed a little bit. So always protect your quads on these races with long downs. So that doesn't mean that you can't go fast. It just means you need to run relaxed and not be absorbing too much energy through your quadriceps. So Chad's heart rate was actually probably low because he's so fit. Mm-hmm. But my guess is the mechanical strain was high. And then Eli put a move on that got a 3-minute gap that was a sight to behold.
And we got to see the move. And his uphill form was so beautiful. It's like, his upper body is relaxed. He's got quick turnover. He's forward lean, light on his feet. It was textbook.
Yeah, watch Eli Hemming's form for a textbook of how we can all have good form.
Because we should post that video on Patreon.
Yeah,
we should post it with this podcast so people can see. And I think the beautiful thing about Eli's form is sometimes when I see runners' forms, it feels impossible to me.
Definitely.
Like, how the heck am I going to emulate
Jim
that?
Jim Walmsley's form is Jim Walmsley.
Yeah, it's like, I can't be Jim Walmsley. Like, that is not in my genetic code.
The bouncy, like, extreme amounts of power, it just doesn't work for most people.
Whereas, I feel like Eli's is intentional. Like, I think that Eli's form is something that everyone can work to achieve. Like, we all can't beat Eli. That's impossible. Eli is so freaking good. But I think elements of his form are very achievable.
Yeah, quick strides. And then the difference with Eli is that each of his strides is massively powerful. And we can't do that. But his form itself is something we can all aspire to. So look to Eli as your motivator, not to, you know, some of the other athletes out there that have a form that works for them, but wouldn't work for most people. And also, I do think Eli is rapidly going to become the best athlete in the world.
I'm so excited.
If he's not already. I mean, you saw before the race, like, I saw some people that didn't pick Eli to win.
And you're like, what is wrong with them?
Yeah, you saw real...
You took offense.
I took offense. I was like, why? You come on. Especially if you're a fan of the sport. It's like, Eli is another level. And I guess maybe they haven't seen his progress like I have behind the scenes. But like, at the same time, he's just wildly good.
He's not consistently on Strava. And I wonder if that's why people like didn't necessarily understand just how good he was.
Dude, if people saw his Strava... that would be insane. Just looking at it with pants down. For women, Allie Mack, Allie McLaughlin, absolutely crushed it. We already talked about her. Very cool. But the big training takeaway about the 23K is that even in these events that are a little bit longer, whether 23K, 46K, 100, 50 miles, 100K, the most important thing is still often your threshold output. Mm-hmm. So for all these athletes, staying at a certain percentage of your threshold or trying to avoid going over that is the difference maker. So what happened on the first lap is there was a relatively solid group of guys. But Eli's threshold is so damn high that he could buffer that effort much better than everybody else. So as the event got to 30, 40 minutes, he was better able to sustain it. In longer events, the same principles apply with how your glycogen is spared, mm-hmm. even if it's not applied in fatigue the same way. So keep raising your threshold. This gets back to the speed elements we talk about. If you can improve your speed, you're also going to improve your endurance. So, you know, your endurance comes from the glycogen sparing effect, or just the fact that your body doesn't undergo the same fatigue processes that happen when the lactate goes super high.
We talk about fatigue resistance, or now durability, which is the term that's being used for it more commonly in like physiological language. But fatigue resistance, I feel like so much of that is actually your ability to clear lactate and to also to lactate buffer and to be mindful of pacing too.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think basically at the end of the day, it's fitness. And so don't forget that like the goal is to become the best runner you can. So any final takeaways from Broken Arrow?
No, just that it was so inspiring.
Yeah.
Like, I think our sport is so cool and it was inspiring across the board. And I feel like the more that we put ourselves out there from the heart, with the head being willing to accept whatever outcomes occur, like the more reward and fun and like epic shit we have ahead in life.
And maybe that's actually something for everyone to do. Choose a race away from home that's kind of big like this, like a bigger race.
And make it a vacation.
And make it a vacation. Yeah. Go with your family or go just experience it yourself. And if you're in the back of the pack, great. Just experience what it can be like in these types of settings, because I think it's just, it was massively cool to get to take pictures with people out there and see them getting so vulnerable in this type of kind of nasty, difficult way.
And go before you're ready in some sense too. I mean, be safe about it, be smart. But one of the really inspiring things for me was seeing Rachel Drake out there. So Rachel Drake, she's, I think, seven or eight months postpartum, coming back from her stress fracture. And she clearly, I mean, she's not in her, Rachel Drake is a world champion type of athlete. She's such a good athlete, but clearly wasn't 100% on top of her form. How could you be given those circumstances? And she went out there and raced and put herself out there. And to me, that was something that was really inspiring. Yeah.
Yeah. Go before you're ready.
Yeah. I like that. Yeah.
I'm going to take that too.
Yeah. Even for PhDs. Do you agree? Stir in the pot over here. I'm making the stir in the pot motion. We have this joke in my family that I like to stir the pot.
You do.
Yeah.
You're quite a pot stirrer.
You're not. You're the opposite of a pot stirrer.
You got that shit stew going.
You're a pot licker.
Hey. Actually, that feels like a compliment. I would eat some pot lickers. Okay. On to some new science really quickly before Western States. This just came out in the Journal of Physiology. The title is Low Energy Availability Reduces Myofibrillar and Sacroplasmic Muscle Protein Synthesis in Trained Females. So at the start, low energy availability, we talk about it all the time. But what the definition is a state where energy intake is insufficient to cover the energy costs of both exercise energy expenditure and basal physiological functions.
And what I love about the study is a lot of the research that's done on low energy availability actually winds up being correlative rather than causative because you can't necessarily induce a state of low energy availability just from like an ethical standpoint. Yeah. But this study did.
Yeah.
They did a randomized control trial, which means they had two groups, and in one of those groups over 10 days, they induced a state of low energy availability. And in the other group, they had a state of normal energy availability, and they were able to look at the differences between the groups. And so we're getting here at more potentially like causative variables as opposed to correlative variables where we're just following athletes after the fact of having low energy availability.
Such a breakthrough, because I think there was a study earlier this year in the Journal of Applied Physiology that looked at the actual impacts of LEA on athletes, low energy availability. And it found that, like, you know, we're not actually sure. We see things after the fact, but until more RCTs come out, randomized controlled trials, we don't know. And what's cool about this study is they did it in that way. Feels a little bit interesting ethically. We probably need to dig into exactly how they got that done. Because
I imagine 10 days is not quite long. I mean, it actually, as we'll see in the study, it does cause massive physiological changes that are potentially harmful to health and performance.
Yeah.
But I imagine if they reestablish energy availability, it's probably okay.
Yeah. And one cool thing here is that they kept protein levels the same. So 1 gram per pound of body weight, partially to measure the protein synthesis. And protein synthesis ends up being a proxy for adaptation markers. So that's why they did it that way. And then they measured a bunch of different things. So protein synthesis, changes in body composition, resting metabolic rate, blood biomarkers, and 24-hour nitrogen balance, along with the, you know, some other things that didn't end up being that relevant in the results.
And so they did this, it was 30 eumenorrheic athletes. So this means these athletes were normally menstruating. So they probably didn't have a history of LEA at the start of the study.
Yeah.
So it was fascinating to have these two different groups, 15 in each group. And what they found, so this is the big takeaway, and it's the money finding in terms of also being in the title too. We're seeing that more and more. These titles are capturing exactly what we're seeing. But they found that the low energy availability group actually had reduced myofibrillar and sarcoplasmic muscle protein synthesis.
Yeah.
And that was translated. So in that low energy availability group, they also had reductions in lean mass.
Yeah.
And reductions in lean mass actually are not great. Because
you're losing your muscle.
You're losing your muscle. Yeah, yeah. We don't want that. And we're seeing that on like a biological level. And then we're also seeing that on a larger body composition level as well.
Yeah. And then you add that with reduced urinary nitrogen balance, reduced free androgen index, reduced thyroid hormone concentrations, and reduced resting metabolic rate.
In just 10 days.
In just 10 days.
Yeah.
It is a full shit show. So essentially what you're going to see in these athletes, and these are our thoughts on the study now, stepping away from the actual researchers' thoughts, is they're going to be responding to training in a much worse way. And not only that, they're probably going to have worse impacts with things like body composition.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think someone might be like, okay, well, 10 days of LEA, like I need to lose weight or whatever, it's going to be fine. And what they found here is that doing it excessively like this, it wasn't done with a nutritionist. It was done in a more extreme way. Like you might see with an athlete that is either restricting or just not thinking about this enough, their resting metabolic rate went down. So the thermostat went way down.
Mm-hmm.
So even though they were consuming less, their body started burning less. And that's why when we talk about food, we're not saying you need to eat Fritos. Like that's our way of trying to take some of the stigma mm-hmm. around different types of food. We like food to generally be whole foods and all that stuff, even though we do like Fritos.
Fritos are delicious.
But the reason for, especially some of the pro athletes we talked about, is that that fire needs to be turned up to 11 all the time in heavy training, because mm-hmm. that's where health happens. That's where good, hormone balances happen, but healthier thyroid hormones.
It's where muscles are made.
Yes.
Yeah.
And performance happens. Like when Eli is running up that hill, you're like, holy shit, that fire is hot. And sure enough, I saw him eating some Kirkland. Actually, he didn't eat Kirkland. He was eating something different. Do you remember?
He was eating a Lara bar.
A Lara bar.
And
okay.
I really like Lara bars pre-workout, so I uplifted that. The Kirkland brownie made my stomach sizzle
but
a little
bit.
But
then Tabor
she
podiumed.
She crushed it. Yeah, she podiumed. Yeah, so the Hemming family is doing it well, Kirkland style. But no, I agree with this. And I think something to me that's fascinating is the idea too that in order to improve from low energy availability and to boost the resting metabolic rate, you have to eat a lot to turn the fire back on.
Definitely.
And for athletes, often they get hungry and hungry and hungry. And that's a great sign that their resting metabolic rate is being dialed up after recovering. So I'd actually be really curious to see what happens to these athletes after the RCT.
Yeah.
Like, how are they then able to reestablish protein synthesis? How are they able to establish like stronger lean body mass? How are they able to reestablish resting metabolic rate? And how long does that take?
Yeah. And you're doing amazing research in this field. So we want to bring you all these types of studies. And we'll keep you updated. As always, if you need to lose weight because the doctor told you, or you have different considerations, it's important to still remember this, because doing it in an unchecked way where you're not doing it scientifically
mm-hmm.
can be really negative for you, even if you like look in the mirror and don't see someone that you think is vulnerable to these same issues, because you are. We all are. It's how human physiology works. So eat enough always. For some individuals, eating enough always might mean you have a small deficit with working with a nutritionist or a doctor because of certain types of health issues. But it should never mean that for performance alone, because performance improves the best when that fire is hot.
Well, I love different analogies. And my favorite LEA analogy is the fire.
Yeah.
Throw Fritos on the fire. Yeah.
Kirkland all the way.
Fritos would really stoke a fire.
Yeah.
Like in like actual practical sense.
Yeah. Fritos is kindling.
Because they're like a little oily, you know?
Oh, could you imagine how it would smell?
Ooh, that would be so delicious.
Oh my God.
We should just really get into like the Frito s'more land.
No,
can you imagine s'mores with Fritos?
S'more Fritos, cool. I like the idea in a practical sense.
Mm-hmm.
But you know what we should do?
What?
Smoke Fritos.
That'd
Could
be
you
exciting.
Imagine? Just I'm vaping, and people are like, "What are you vaping?" And I'm like,
"Frito."
I'm actually a Cheetos man myself.
Hydrogenated oils.
Yeah. Oh my God. I feel like my performance is improving as we talk. Okay. Do you want to do the question on LEA or get straight to Western States?
Let's get straight to Western States, just because I want to make sure we do justice to Western States. This is like the one time of year we get to tee up Western States, and I'm so excited for it.
Okay. So this year is going to be wild. And we had some really interesting performance data that we wanted to start with, that we wanted to talk about, that is exclusive to the SWAT podcast. That article is coming out today. It comes from Professor Marshall Burke at Stanford, who's one of the most brilliant guys ever. He was actually at Megan's dissertation defense.
It was so meaningful. Yeah, Marshall, thank you for coming. Yeah. That was great.
He's absolutely one of the smartest people of all time.
And he does a lot of work related to wildfire smoke, environmental change.
You might
change.
Have seen him in the New York Times recently.
Yes.
He's been featured in every major publication in the last few weeks as the fires have been running out of control. But he also loves ultra running and did a really cool statistical analysis on the best performances ever in the history of Western states.
And what I love about this and what you so astutely put together in your Toronto Magazine article is I feel like there's been all this like moneyballing effect on sports. Like we have this deep dive on statistics in baseball and basketball, and it's informing how the sport is being played. Like you think about basketball, basketball players are taking threes now way more than ever because that was something that was stats derived. Yeah. And for me, as like someone that loves science, I love the intersection between stats and sports and how that shifts like how we think about sports, how sports are being played. And this is an example where stats are informing ultra running.
I should have talked about that a little bit more in the article, because in the article I framed it in the context of baseball advanced statistics, also called sabermetrics, which I was obsessed with when I was a little kid.
I had never heard the term sabermetrics before yesterday.
Yeah. Well, you probably had more boyfriends than I had girlfriends. In fact, I should have made that point four on my article discussion or my discussion outline with my seventh grade girlfriend. She probably would have been really interested in sabermetrics.
I probably wouldn't be here. You two would just be banging together with like four kids.
Yeah. I tell that sweet honey about wins above replacement. She's right. Okay, you got the idea. That is a really fascinating point that like the way that we gather the statistics ends up changing the game, way the game's played. So threes in basketball is a great example. In baseball, the big example is strikeouts and home runs. Essentially, we have learned over time through this stat called fielding independent pitching that a pitcher can't really control how many balls that are put in play that actually the hitter hits become hits.
Which is scary when you think about that.
Because it makes no sense. You would think that, well, some great pitchers just get less strong contact, so they're going to be better. But what we found out is that actually all the pitcher really controls, for the most part, there are a few exceptions, are strikeouts, walks, home runs, and hit by pitches. So things that are directly in their control. And what that did is, this was in the early 2000s, it caused people to value home runs from hitters and strikeouts from pitchers and devalue things like speed and base running and stuff like that. And baseball is trying to change the rules to get the game back to where it was because it became so skewed from the way it had been played forever. The game didn't change at all, like the actual style of the game, but our understanding of it did. And I think that that's what Marshall's data here really does.
Do you think ultra running is going to change the rules now that we have a stats-based approach? I don't think so.
I like to think that what Swap has done is come in with a new style of approaching ultra running that people have had to catch up with. Mm-hmm. And our style is based on a lot of statistical analysis and research. So, you know, I think there are proxies. I don't know if it's exactly going to come from how people run the races, but maybe it will. And I mean, we have some theories about this data set. So we're going to start with the best performances ever for women. The analogy here with baseball is that Ann Trason is the Babe Ruth of ultra running.
Which Ann Trason, she's like her own, she is the Babe Ruth. And there's some like female athlete corollary to Babe Ruth. I started panicking.
Babe Didrikson, I think, is like, Zaharias was like the best player back in the early 40s, 50s, across a range of sports. She's essentially Jim Thorpe, but for women, who won everything. But Babe Ruth, back in the day, in 1920, he essentially invented a new way of hitting where he would just swing for the fences, but doing it with this interesting way. He hit 54 home runs that year, and in a time when the best team in the league, other than him, hit 50. So, similarly, Ann Trason came along and totally changed the way women's running occurred.
And I think in the process, she encouraged more women to participate too.
Yeah.
Like I'd be actually curious to look at the average gender place time when Ann Trason was running. And this is part of what the model does compared to now and how the sport has progressed because of Ann Trason.
Definitely.
Like how she's cleared the path forward for women athletes in ultra
running. I think that's what we're seeing. Like the women's times are improving so fast across the board. And so what Marshall had to do is two types of models to calculate best performance ever. Both of the models are based on the average finisher time in that year. But then where they diverge is that the first model assumes that that athlete did not run that year. So Ann Trason didn't run that year. What time would we expect it to win? The second model, which Marshall prefers, is what would happen if Ann Trason never existed or whoever won never existed.
Which is a scary thought to think about. Yes. Yeah.
But that way they're not competing against themselves and devaluing some of their future performances with their past performances and that sort of thing. And what we found is if you assume that Ann Trason never existed, she has 13 of the 14 best performances ever at Western States, including like the top six. What the fuck? That is wild.
It is so wild. And when we look at the actual metrics of that, we're looking at the difference between the predicted time. So we're using the model to calculate the predicted time and what the athlete actually ran. So Ann Trason is accumulating of these top performances, huge deltas in terms of the difference between predicted time and what she actually ran based on the conditions of things like snow and temperature, and controlling for the fact that if we think about the average finisher time probably accounts for a number of those variables. Definitely. Like snow and temperature and things along those lines.
But when you do the other model, I actually have a little bit of a problem with that model being applied to Ann, because she won so many times that you end up throwing out a pretty large ream of data. Like, mm-hmm. It's different when an athlete wins twice, like Ellie Greenwood, and you throw out that data. If you throw out Ann's, you know, whatever number of wins, 14, I believe, and I believe in eight of those, she finished top six overall. If you throw out all that, you're ending up tossing a lot. In the other model, Ellie Greenwood's course record of 16:47 is the best performance ever. And so we want to uplift that and say Ellie's times are insane. But another interesting wrinkle is the last 4 years that Western States has been run, there was not run in the COVID year, all had historical performances that were 20 to 40 minutes faster than the model. So we're looking at Courtney in 2018, Claire in 2019, Ruth Croft, Beth Pascal in flipped order. And the model this year, because it's only supposed to be 78 degrees at Auburn,
which is so exciting,
as a race day high, predicts 17:06.
But if you do the math on that and you subtract 20 minutes from 17:06, we're getting down near the course record.
Getting to 16:46.
Yes.
Compared to that 16:47 course record. So that we're just teeing that up, because I think that this year in the cool weather, we're going to talk a little bit about conditions in a second. The model says that the time's going to be fast. And what we've seen from this model is that recent history in women's running has been breaking model predictions, because it's getting so much faster all the time.
Especially so much faster for the podium finishers.
Yes.
Yes.
And so I think the women's race is going to be hot this year. And we'll talk about predictions in a second. Very quickly for men, the model distinctions didn't make that much of a difference for men, because there's no Ann Trason that just kind of skews everything. Mm-hmm. But as always,
There is a Jim Walmsley.
Yes, yeah. And he had three of the best performances ever. Fascinatingly, his slowest year, 2021, was his best performance. And not only the best performance, it was twice as good as any other run that's ever happened at Western States.
Well, if you look at, his expected time based off of the model and what he actually ran, it was something like a 2 hour difference because it was so hot. Yeah.
Yeah. And what we're seeing there is the effect of heat on men's performances is incredibly pronounced, much more so than female performances, interestingly. Might get to some of the theories of physiology between men and women and how they differ.
Also, perhaps some of the theories of pacing too.
Yeah.
I think women are really smart pacers, and the research and data have shown that time and time again.
Yeah.
And you'd be curious to know if like men going out too hot in the heat implodes the field a little bit more than the women.
Maybe. And the interesting part there is that the fastest time ever before Jim, which I believe was Timothy Olsen's time, is way down on the list.
It was a cool year. Yeah.
The model actually predicts that exact time being run that year. And I think that just shows how much temperature matters for the male times relative to the female times. Mm-hmm. And that brings us to our 2023 predictions. So we have a cool year. We have snow in the high country. So the first 30 miles are going to be very slow. But it'll still reward great pacing, because from Forest Hill to the finish, we're probably going to see records set. So here are my predictions, and you can tell me if you agree or disagree. You ready?
Yep. I love it.
The first one is that we're going to see a women's course record and the best performance ever.
100% by who?
I'm not going to say. I don't want to put pressure on that person.
But I will say, that person loves pressure.
Yeah.
I'm sure that person, like, I'm coming into this new relationship with pressure.
Yeah.
That person was born coming out of the womb with a love of pressure. I can almost feel it.
I did talk to that person at Broken Arrow, because they were there.
That person got to hang with Leo at Broken Arrow. Yeah. And I was like, Leo, you're in the presence of greatness.
I actually took a picture that we're talking about Courtney. If you didn't know, I took a picture of Leo looking up at Courtney while Courtney wasn't looking, because I was like, I didn't want to be weird and ask her for a picture, but I think Leo's going to really value that when he's older, because she's the best. So that's my prediction for the women's race.
I agree.
In general, though, there's going to be a big spread between first and 10th, because snow often does cause big spreads, even if the top time is going to be fast. And I think the reason it's different for women than men is because the high country, you don't need to blitz as fast to run 16:46 as you do to run sub 15 hours, because you cannot lose time in the high country and run a 14 hour time. And I think that gets to my men's prediction.
So if you set out to run a 14-hour time and you're doing so through snow, it's so likely you're going to implode at the end of the race.
And you're just going to be wasting so much energy. I mean,
exactly.
The snow is going to be tough up there, which brings me to my men's prediction. So the model has two different predictions. One is if you assume Jim never existed, because Jim is so fast that it actually thinks that the winning time this year will be 14:24.
Based on Jim, yeah.
Just because of Jim. But if you take Jim out, it says 14:41.
And Jim's not going to be there. But you also wonder the pacing. So if Jim is there, how does that impact the pacing of 2, 3, 4, 5?
Yeah.
And thus also like the average finisher too.
Definitely. So if we're looking at 14:41, 1 for the model prediction. I think it's going to be slower than that. I think men are going to be over 15 hours. And it just gets back to, like, even though we have some of the best men that we've ever seen, running fast in that snow is going to punish people that go out too fast. And this year, too fast is going to feel relatively easy for those athletes because they are so used to running quickly. So I think the men's time is either going to come from someone that paces more conservatively this year, which is rare. Usually it comes from someone that just goes off the front.
Like Tyler Green is a great example.
Tyler Green, yes, great example of someone that could win this year. Or it's going to come from someone who fades less than the others. A good example being Tom Evans. I think Tom Evans or Matthew Blanchard, but my particular pick for this race is Tom Evans. Hayden Hawks would be another great prediction, or Anthony Costales or someone like that. But I would say Tom Evans is who I'm, you know, choosing for the men.
I actually 100% agree. This is like one of the first times that we're in 100% concordance on things.
Well, especially in sports. We like to go.
We like to disagree. Yeah. It's kind of fun. We stew in that. It's good. But one question I have actually is I would love to go back in the historical data and understand. I imagine the years that there's more snow in the high country, there's actually a higher correlation to it being cooler out on like down in Auburn.
Yeah.
I would also love to look at years that have more snow in the high country and then like baking heat in Auburn and just kind of understand how those two variables interact with each other.
Yeah. And it points out the failure of the model to predict winning times because it relies on average finish time of that year. Mm-hmm. So without that variable, you end up predicting based on historical trends and temperature only. So you're missing the key variable. So what we might see is that this year is slow for everybody and we don't know it till after the fact. Mm-hmm. Or we might see it's actually fast for everybody and it's not a big issue. But I predict that this year is going to be, slower than people think for men, faster than people think for the winning, maybe the podium women. But then, you know, across the board, maybe just kind of right on the model predictions.
How are you using that information to talk to athletes that are racing both at the front of the pack and middle and back of the pack?
Well, I mean, I think it nails exactly how you always want to race this race, particularly for female athletes, which is conserve the first 30 miles. You know,
there's no reason to go out and push.
There's no reason. I mean, when Kat Bradley won in a snow year that was also hot, which is different than this year in 2017, she was in 18th place early on in the race, like well into the race, a few hours into the race. And it points out that you can do that. This year is going to be cooler, so you don't want to put yourself too far back. You need to at least be in somewhat contention, I think, if you are planning to podium. But if you're planning to top 10, you know, anywhere within an hour at 30 miles is fine. So don't stress too much and go out conservatively because the high country is going to be difficult. That first 30 miles, it's not just going to be snowy. There's going to be periods where you drop down into a little crevasse. You face plant, you do all these different things that just make the day feel longer. But then later on, it's going to be one of the fastest Western states we've ever seen.
And also biomechanically too, running on snow is a totally different stress. Like some of these athletes probably haven't trained a ton on snow. And then to then be expected to run fast and close is something unique as well.
Yeah. We're going to be able to tell a lot at Forest Hill. I think this is the year where at Forest Hill, you need to be ready to hunt. You'd be like, I am ready to throw the fuck down because those times from Forest Hill to Rucky Chucky to the river, which is like a slight down for people that don't know, that's not that technical, are going to be blazing relative to historical times.
Actually, one stat that I want to look at is DNF rates within the top 20 and how that's evolved as the sport has progressed as Western states. I feel like Western states has become so elevated in terms of, maybe it's just because I wasn't involved in ultra running in 1995, but I feel like Western states itself has received so much hype. How has that impacted DNF rates? How has like understanding and knowledge and these different, you know, things that we approach Western states with, how has that impact DNFs?
Yeah. And when it brings us back to baseball stats, actually. So, you know, wins above replacement has Babe Ruth as the best player of all time, as we talked about. But of course he's not the best player of all time. He played in like the old days.
It was segregated then.
It was segregated. I mean, most of all, it was segregated. Yes. Like, no one that played before segregation can have any argument to that. But even independent of that, the players weren't as good. He's hitting home runs off of people that threw middle school fastballs now. You put Babe Ruth in the modern era, or even back then, he's playing against Smokey Joe Williams in the 1930 Negro Leagues. He wouldn't hit as many home runs. You put him now with 100 mile an hour exploding cut fastballs. Yeah, he's not as great either. I still think he would be a really good player. I don't think he'd be the greatest of all time. And with running, let's say, there's also been a development of the sport. Not as pronounced because we're only talking, you know, 15, 20 years ago now, but there's still been development, especially for this type of model, which is looking at the average finisher.
Well, there's been development in training theory and fueling and cooling and applying all of this to the model to me is fascinating.
Yeah. So in other words, we're grading people in the modern era against a curve of times getting faster across the board. And Marshall didn't use the top 10 times or top 20 times because of how those individual outliers influence those. But I'd be fascinated to see the same model applied to like top 20 times. I think basically what we're saying is training theory has changed the way the game is played. And every single year, we don't know exactly what we're getting, because this could be the year of the leap where everything changes. Like when Jim first came into the scene. Mm-hmm. And I think that with Courtney this year in the cool, I think we might see that for women. With men in the snow, exercise caution. If you're out there listening and you're going to be racing, it's still 100 miles. It's still snowy. It's still hard. Make sure you save your energy.
I love that. Yeah. And make sure you're ready to run at the end.
Yeah.
Yeah. Also, that's going to be such fun running. I mean, yeah. It's still going to be hot out there. It's bonkers to me. So you did Canyon's 100K. It was way hotter in at April. Canyon's 100K in April than it's going to be out at Western States. 15 degrees
hotter. Yeah. Oh my God. If I had this condition, I might be at Western States right now.
Oh, that's what. No, would we have taken the golden ticket?
No.
I would have made you.
You would have made me. Yeah. No, and also that's not true, because like the people that got the golden tickets were far better than me, but
no.
Okay. I mean, we'll
disagree.
We need to uplift. We raced. They kicked my ass.
That's actually a good point. I have raced competitors before that have like, I would have run the race if X, Y, and Z.
Yeah.
And I had in fact won the race, and I was like, yo, bitch, we raced and I beat you. So I agree with point. Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, I got my ass handed to me, but I do love the belief that you need to have as an athlete. Like, you need to feel like if I just did something differently, it would have been okay. So always hold that. Like, it's not making excuses to be like, I could have done better. It just sets you up for the future to work harder next time. And that's my hope for the next one we do.
I totally agree.
Okay. Do you want to talk about any individual storylines in this process?
I do. Okay, I think the storylines are so cool. And this is, I think it's hard to cover last year we covered every single athlete, and it was a little daunting because we don't want to miss anyone. Like, we want to uplift everyone on this. So I think
we don't know all the stories.
Let's cover just particular stories that we know and love. And this is just in no random, this is in random order. Yeah.
For rooting interests. I mean, so many inspirational people out there. I want to start with one of your athletes, Ling Yingling, last year, first American. She's queen of closing. Might this be an interesting race for that.
Perfect for her. Yeah. Yes. Queen of closing. That being said, she's great in heat. So even if it was hot, I think this race would be excellent for her. She's in a great spot training.
Yeah.
And I think she's very smart. I think this type of course where you have to think on the fly and adapt and adjust is going to be outstanding for her.
I can't wait to see what she does. She's also part of the Lululemon Further Project.
Yes.
Uplifting women's sports. So go, Leah. I wanted to give a shout out to Riley Brady, non-binary boss athlete who's going to be competing in the women's division for results, the purpose of results. Riley is so fucking fit right now.
Scary fit.
So
they've also used her sauna. Yeah, so they're prepared for weird. Our sauna is strange. It's like a very humid sauna.
Yeah.
They're prepared for heat and humidity.
Might be some Fritos smoke in that sauna.
Yeah, it definitely has a lot of some Fritos vape.
There's definitely some smell going on. But watch out for Riley. You know, even as we Courtney is GOAT. So like we uplift Courtney. There's a lot that can happen. I mean, Courtney was in the 2019 race that Claire won. So like, we think Courtney has deserved the right to be the favorite.
She's the leader of the GOAT herd, but I would say there is a large GOAT herd.
Yeah. Or there's a lot of people that are motivated by Courtney.
Yes, you know, exactly. Like, yeah.
I know for a fact, Riley has been, you know, in their introduction to the sport, Courtney has been their motivator. Much like I said to Grayson, when we interviewed Grayson, I was like, Grayson, the person that you beat is going to be a 12-year-old that you inspired. Or the person that beat you is going to be a 12-year-old that you inspired.
Do you know what this makes me think of? Is the Andre Agassi biography, which is so, we are just starting to listen to it. It's like one of my favorite books of all time.
Yeah. Record scratch. Stop the podcast right now and listen to this. If you have not listened or read Open by Andre Agassi, which came out like 10 years ago, I believe, the best writing, best book ever. Like, I never wanted to read it because I don't care that much about tennis. But
we care a lot about tennis. We like all sports. Yeah, it's fun to watch. Yeah.
We do like all sports. But at the same time, after a certain point, I'm like, people are just grunting.
They're grunting in white clothes
for 4 or 5 hours. It's like, come on, a little much.
I think it's cool,
but the book itself is incredible.
But I think it describes like the input into a psyche of a top level athlete. But he was describing at the end of his career how he was playing someone who looked up to him as a kid, and that kid emulated his playing style. And so when he stepped on the court, he was like, "I'm playing this kid with my playing style." He's basically like facing my younger me. How daunting is that? But I think any great that goes through sport, like Grayson or Courtney, they're informing the next wave of sport, and they'll get to a point where, you know, they're 40, 45 and racing a kid that's coming in that's been training by their principals. And how cool is that?
Yeah. Or, you know, in Grayson's case, like maybe she'll be 30 and some kid that just won an NCAA championship will face her. You know what I mean? So that is motivated because they're doing this because of Grayson.
And I think Grayson and Courtney are the type of people that will uplift.
Definitely. Yeah.
Yes. But they're also competitive, fiery people too. And it's going to motivate the heck
out of them. It's not going to happen easy. It's like when I'm playing one-on-one basketball with Leo, I've already thought about this. It's like, that bitch ain't beating me until he beats me. He's got to earn that.
I love that. Yeah. That's how I always play. Like growing up with like kids I babysat, that's how I played.
Yeah. elbows straight to the fucking face. Next up, Katie Asmuth, and she's coming back from foot surgery. So last year at Western States, she finished ninth with a broken foot. It's a type of very serious foot injury that would have put Western States...
Broken navicular, yeah.
...into questionable territory this year. But not only that, not only has she come back, she's in fantastic shape.
How she's come back from surgery is inspiring. I've had surgery before, and I would say sometimes, I mean, it depends on the surgery. Sometimes it takes a year to feel like yourself post-surgery. Yeah. And she's not even a year out from her surgery at Western States. And what she's doing to step on that starting line is cool.
To me, she leads with her heart more than almost anybody. Like, you know, she like I remember her doing 3 hard elliptical workouts a week for like 8 weeks after 6 weeks of full recovery. And the whole time, I bet she was thinking about Forest Hill.
Yeah.
You know? Mm-hmm. And so when you're out there, like when you're watching this race or tracking it, make sure you're cheering Katie. She's the best. We already talked about Courtney, the GOAT. Always interested in Camille Herron on the start line. You know, you can't doubt someone that has this many world records. The snow might be a question mark for her.
I think that's challenging with her form.
But if she gets over the snow,
she's going to be tough.
If she gets to Forest Hill in a good position, this could be a year where we see 2 GOATs going head to head.
And she finished in the top 10 last year. She had prior DNF'd. And I thought it was inspiring because it might not have been the position in the top 10 that she wanted to finish. And she did it. She like stayed committed to that. And I thought like she didn't have to finish that race and she did it. Yeah,
it was remarkable. Next up, Katie Scheid, golden ticket after winning UTMB. It's a hard way to get a golden ticket.
Yeah, I feel like anyone that gets a golden ticket from UTMB should automatically be in the top storyline.
To say that athlete's going to step up, ready to throw down.
And she ran a fast 50-mile race in I think it was in Costa Rica, somewhere warm. So that's a good sign for Western States.
Yeah, next up, another comeback story, Keely Henninger. Last year, she was in podium position, I believe, when she sprained her ankle and had to drop out. We love Keely. Keely's brilliant. She's helping push the field of women's athlete research forward.
Keely's great, but ankles are heinous. When she sprained her ankle, I felt that so deeply on a visceral level because I sprain my ankles all the time. But doing so in a race when you're like that far in podium position it's so hard.
Yeah, and she's ready to go. And then final one, little one that we're going to talk about is Heather Jackson. We talked about her briefly here before. She's been doing these epic bike races where she's excelled, like bike races over
gravel rides.
So long. So we're seeing someone that has this incredible endurance background where she's
former Ironman triathlete,
probably did 25, 30 hour training weeks in Ironman coming to running. And so will be interesting to see.
Yeah. I was just thinking about Ironman. Surely be iron people.
Yeah, it really should.
Yeah.
That is kind of problematic.
Yeah. I had never thought about that until I said it now.
Yeah.
Well, Iron Woman. I was going to call her Iron Woman. And I was like, damn, why are we genderizing this?
That's true. Yeah. Iron Beast or something. You just change it to
Iron Beast. I like that.
Iron Boss.
Iron Boss.
Something like that.
Yeah.
Okay. Next up, some men's storylines. Not as many here. Adam Peterman out this year, unfortunately, after winning last year. We love Adam, as you know from listening to this podcast.
The Peter God has a sacral stress fracture. Yeah. It happens to us all.
Even the Peter God must rest on the seventh day, is what we have learned. Hayden Hawks has progressed at this race from 6th to 2nd.
Oh, his training is great. Yeah.
Training is great. So good to go.
I worry a little bit because he's so fast that I think if the snow wasn't there, we would see him run a blazing fast time. That I feel for him a little bit in the snow because I don't think it's necessarily like, I mean, it probably is his strength because he's good at everything, but I don't think it necessarily fits into his running style.
Definitely. Arlen Glick, 3rd place finisher last year, been putting in epic training on the course. He also runs in snow plenty in the winter. So I think he's probably the dark horse pick for me of if I had to pick someone, like if I was betting on this and I had to put down money and there were odds, there might actually be somewhere. Let us know if there's any betting odds in ultra running. My guess is that his would be lower than they should be. And that's where I'd put my big bet for dark horse.
I like that. Do you have a women's dark horse?
Can it be dark horse when someone's 3rd place?
Yeah. Do you have a women's dark horse?
I mean, there's so many good women out there. And so the problem is I want to say a swap athlete.
I was gonna say we have bias here. Yeah.
Recusing myself from saying a swap athlete.
Sure. Yeah. No swap athletes in the pick.
No swap athletes. Keely.
Yeah, I agree.
I think people are probably underestimating how good
Keely is. I think people understand how good Keely is.
Yeah. But I mean,
I think Keely could win.
Definitely.
Yes. Yeah.
And then Matthew Blanchard also got a spot from a UTMB golden ticket, which is incredible. That's badass. And finally, Tom Evans. I think, so Tom is incredibly fast. He's done a ton of really impressive road builds. And he's bringing that into the race with incredible trail speed, success at Western States in his past. He has podiumed in 2019 in a very fast time. I think he knows what it takes to be the person to run something like a 14:20, 14:30. So if my prediction is wrong and the time is under 15 hours, if we're looking at, let's say the winner is 14:20, I would almost guarantee that was Tom Evans, but I could be totally wrong on that.
Well, I think what's really cool about the predictions is that in the model, there's a bunch of variables that you can control and then a bunch of variables that are totally uncontrollable. And I think this year is all about controlling the controllables and being willing and flexible to iterate and adapt on the fly.
Yeah.
And you had this great, great piece of writing in the Toronto Magazine article that you wrote. And you actually asked me this morning, you said, Megan, should I delete this? I don't feel very strongly about it. And I was like, David, I just put it in the podcast outline. It's so good.
Well, I talked about baseball statistics for like 3 pages at this point.
And it was good.
Oh my God. I was so sick of myself.
But I think you should read this because I think sometimes I really struggle with like feeling like the uncontrollables are out of my hand to play.
Yeah.
And sometimes being frustrated by that. But I think that is the essence of trail running. And you described that so beautifully here that can you, I was going to read this, but these are your words. Well, so context, you'll do better justice.
For context, this is about, was in something talking about fielding independent pitching. That statistic I talked to you before where the amount of balls put into play don't necessarily matter. All the pitcher controls are these true outcomes of the game, they call them. And so here it is. There are things you control: training, cooling, logistics, mindset. There are many more things you don't control: health, temperature, snow, trail conditions, and all of the other vagaries of race day. Think about what you control and try to remember that the uncontrollable variables are what make ultra running so special. When there are two outs and the bases are loaded, just like when there's a make or break moment in an ultra, it doesn't matter how much good luck or bad luck led to that moment. What matters is the underlying fundamental elements of performance you can control. There's a lot of luck involved in all of this stuff, but luck plays a lot smaller role if you take a deep breath, regroup, and strike the next hitter out.
I love that so much. I've been in a position before where I've like made wrong turns, or I've been there where like things are just out of my hand. And I think it's really about like, this is why we do it. Like, this is why we take a deep breath and recenter ourselves and put ourselves back up at plate to be in the pressure of the moment. And I think the more that we can do that and channel that swag energy walking to the start line or even in the middle, like walking through Forest Hill, do that.
And that's why we like talking about elite athlete stories because of those, like the story element of it. Mm-hmm. But these happen everywhere. And it's why we want you to put yourself out there and do something big and scary and vulnerable, because that's where you learn so much about yourself and start to understand, oh shit, the stuff that applies to running is actually just a metaphor for life. And I think that's why ultra running can be so fucking magical.
It's such a great place to put yourself in the pressure cooker.
Yes.
I'm feeling the pressure cooker.
Oh my gosh. Yes, yeah. Yes. Okay. So let's just do a couple hot takes because we're already pretty far along. So we have a bunch listed. We'll save a lot of them.
Our hot takes are so good.
They're so good. We have like hundreds of them.
We're going to keep this as a recurring segment. So keep sending them in because also we get so much joy reading them. I've been thinking a lot about life from our hot takes.
Yeah. So if you want to see the rest of them, it's an incredible list. Patreon.com/swap, SWAP. There we do a bonus podcast every single week that's 30 minutes long. We also do Sexy Science Corner posts and answer all of your questions. Okay, I'm going to start with this one. Hoka's best road shoes are their trail shoes.
I'm so glad you started with this one. I was actively thinking about this yesterday as I was running up a road climb in the Hoka Mafates.
Yeah.
I was like, these shoes are great on the roads.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't love their road shoes.
Yeah, we actually spent a good bit of last week's Patreon podcast shitting on one particular type of Hoka road shoe. I'm not going to say it right now because... you know, we don't want to downlift.
What is it about the shoe that we don't uplift?
About that particular shoe?
Yeah. I mean, everything and everything, but like...
Everything. It's the worst. It causes climate change. Single-handedly. It's why the guy fucked the dog, is that shoe.
But there's such a polarizing thing because we have a shoe that causes climate change on the road models. And then the Mafate is like the best shoe ever.
Yeah.
How does this happen?
I don't know. And honestly, it's just been a meme in our relationship.
It is a meme in our relationship.
So we kind of like this listener, but they're just playing into... There's playing to the crowd. They know exactly what we want. Okay, next up. Ankles are stupid, poorly designed mechanisms of pain.
I agree. I spend like at least once a week praying to the ankle gods and just screaming fuck to the universe because I've wrecked my ankle.
The cool thing though is once you've twisted your ankles enough, they're kind of like respond pretty quickly to twists. But we have learned for both of us, we don't have ligaments left. The ATFL ligament is gone for both of us from severe sprains we've had. It's probably gone for a lot of you listeners. Like if you got an MRI, someone look at it and be like, oh, this thing is fucked. Can you even run?
Well, also be careful too, because a lot of orthopedic surgeons will look at that and be like, you need surgery. But some of the ankle tightening surgeries can be really challenging in terms of like output for running mechanics and things like that. So always get second opinions.
I generally advise
surgical second opinion. Yeah, I do too.
What we like doing is trying to give ourselves a type of tendon or a ligament with taping. So what I found is if I tape my ankle, even if I'm not worried about sprains, it makes me feel more stable and I run a little bit better. So I've started taping on every single run. We have a tutorial video online.
Even on road runs.
I
feel like it gives me a little more power.
It just, it gives me a little more confidence. Maybe it's purely placebo, but I mean, it can't be at this point. And the way we strap it, it essentially, overlaps with where the ligament would be. So it's not obviously as strong as the ligament, but it might be a 5% push that gives you a little bit more confidence if you're the type of person that has those issues. And it's so easy. All you need is athletic tape that you can find at any supermarket or CVS or something.
It's so easy, but invariably it takes like 5 minutes to do it. And I'm going out the door. I'm like, oh, I got to tape my ankles.
Same. Yeah. But it's worth it.
Yes.
Okay. Final one. Hot take. Foam rolling and massage guns are bullshit and voodoo. They ain't breaking down adhesions. They're just fancy neural modulators.
Ooh. Well, I feel like
that's a hot take.
That is a hot take. They're coming into our relationship because I'm kind of, I don't know, maybe I'm just lazy because I'm like, oh, foam rolling. Yeah. Meanwhile, you are obsessed with foam rolling. But I do think they're helpful. Yeah.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
And there are studies actually that back up, especially Megan, like vibration techniques.
Yeah. You were the type of athlete that, or type of person that we opened the graduation thing actually expecting to like 50-50 see your name there because of like that type of focus on that. So I don't know if we should pay attention to your foam rolling. Like, do you do it each night?
Because do I do it each night? No.
It's much like, you know, did I file this paperwork? No, I didn't file that paperwork.
But you do it each night.
I do. Yeah. And I file your paperwork for you too.
That's why I married you. Exactly. Purely for the paperwork and partially so I can watch you foam roll and feel a little less good about myself. Actually, every time I watch you foam roll, I'm like, oh, such an overachiever.
Yeah. I am pretty good at overachieving.
Yeah.
But with this take, I actually think it's immensely wrong. And
I do. I agree too. Yeah.
And the reason is because in any elite training group, massage ends up being a really big part of what they do. Mm-hmm. And unless you have a masseuse, you're just not going to do that. And it's not just running. Like if you were watching the Tour de France documentary, which we really recommend on Netflix,
they do massages every night,
every single day.
Okay. I would do that. Yeah. I would lay on a table for some guy to massage my legs every
night. Some guy?
Yeah.
Some guy.
You.
Okay. Me. Okay.
Just you.
Actually, no, it can be.
Your seventh grade girlfriend can come too.
Yeah. Yeah. You can get massages from any guy. It's totally uplifted in this house. But, the reason that they do that is because without them, their bodies start to break down. So clearly we're seeing some sort of benefit here. Whether that comes from foam rolling and massage guns is debatable, but the studies are actually very good on percussive massage in particular.
Oh, percussive massage is great. Yeah.
So to this listener, I say, they may be voodoo as it relates to some of the stated explanations in Runner's World, or maybe even that I'll say in an offhanded way sometimes, but they are not bullshit and voodoo as it comes to keeping athletes healthy and helping mm-hmm. them recover.
I think especially if you have an injury, kind of our, I would say it's like our second line of defense against like preventing injuries and also recovering from injuries. It's just having David massage the shit out of an area. Yeah. And it usually does tend to recover.
Yeah.
Yeah. You have magical hands.
I just beat you like a piece of meat. You know how like to
you tenderize my quads.
Chicken fried steak or whatever, you beat it with a hammer. That's kind of what I do to your quads.
Yeah, my vulva. That's the last vulva joke. Oh, we're going out on top.
Should we end there? Should we do listener corner?
We should do listener corner. Oh. We can't end there.
Why? That was the biggest mic drop ever. I feel like the mic now, it's not even picking us up because it's on the floor. There's no way this is getting any better than that. Okay, we'll read it begrudgingly. Congratulations on 3 years of podcasts. I almost didn't keep listening after my first listen involved you and Megan disregarding your home inspection. But I'm glad I kept going as the podcast has been a great part of my running journey over the past 18 months or so. I'm not generally an ultra or trail runner, but my main running goals are to maintain the joy I get from running and avoid injuring myself. So everything about Swap dovetails with those goals. Thanks to you both for putting yourselves and your knowledge out into the world.
Oh, that means a ton. Hopefully we're contributing to the percussive massage vibes of the world.
Yeah. You know, one interesting thing about this message is we get a fair number of messages that kind of start like this.
Like, I wasn't sure about you guys. You were like, weird.
It's like, I kind of hate everything you stand for, but... No, they didn't say that. This listener was very nice about it. But occasionally we'll get someone that does say like, you know, I don't agree with your politics. I don't agree with like your general approach to training. But like, I still listen to your podcast every week and thank you.
It actually means a ton.
No, I actually
if you're here and you like disagree with us on like politics or fundamental things, like thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I actually like those emails more than
I'm sure anything. We're like annoying as heck in that case and you've prevailed.
But I mean, I like that because I hope we preside a context that as long as you're coming from a place of love and inclusion generally in the world, like we understand that we might not be right on everything. And we're just two people talking into a mic about fun things.
While hunched over.
Yeah. And
like grandparents. Yes.
If you ever met us, like you would hopefully like in person see that we really do just like, we're so curious and want to learn. So if this was a three-way conversation, I'm sure this listener would tell us great things about home inspections and what we need to know.
I'm so excited. Well, if you are wanting to come up to us at Forest Hill, come say hi.
Yeah.
Talk to us about home inspections.
Maybe Leo will be there, hopefully.
Tell us what we need to know. It's going to be the most fun weekend of the year, whether you're following it on live coverage or there at Forest Hill or just watching it on Twitter.
You know what I should have brought?
What?
Athletic Greens travel packs to hand out.
Yes! Just give it out like Halloween candy?
I have some.
Or should we just give it to the racers at Forest Hill? Change their race around with some Midwestern States Athletic Greens.
Yeah, we're actually here in Tahoe staying with a swap athlete who is a big Athletic Greens fanatic too.
Almost more diligent than we are with
Way
Athletic Greens.
Way more diligent than me.
Yes. Well, of course, everyone's more diligent than us.
So we are the biggest fans of this product. It is what helps the podcast keep going. But also, you know, when we talk about these pro athletes, most of them nowadays are taking Athletic Greens. So clearly there is either, whether there's benefit or not, we don't want to say for sure because obviously there aren't the controlled studies.
Okay, I'm a skeptic and I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, yes. I mean, I'm pretty sure.
I'm saying pretty sure because I always qualify everything, but yeah. I'm pretty baffled.
I mean, it's made a huge difference in my aging process. So if you're like worried about these types of things, especially stress and how it built up over time.
In your aging process, you look beautiful.
I do.
Yeah, maybe it's why you look so great right now.
Oh, yeah. drinkag1.com/swap, S-W-A-P.
To look as good as David.
No, don't take it for that reason because everyone's going to be turned off and cancel their subscriptions. And we need that sweet, sweet subscription swag. But that's a new link and it's in the notes. drinkag1.com/SWAP.
And we love you all.
We love you all so much.
Huzzah!
Huzzah!